This is the Incoming Podcast. I am Michael Cox. In this episode, I speak with Stephen Posner, the Director of Pathways to Planetary Health at the Garrison Institute. The Garrison Institute is located in Garrison, New York, along the Hudson River. Its mission is to apply the skills and wisdom cultivated through contemplative practice, together with the insights emerging from science, to today's urgent social and environmental challenges, leveraging transformational change in helping build a more compassionate, resilient future. Stephen obtained his PhD in natural resources from the University of Vermont in 2015 and has maintained an interesting research program that, among other things, has focused on the role of boundary actors, or actors and organizations who are able to bridge gaps between groups and perspectives. During our conversation, we talked about the traditional models for these types of actors and what makes a good boundary spanner. In keeping with the philosophy of the Garrison Institute, a part of Stephen's answer to this latter question was the practice of looking inward, or what he calls self-attention work, and developing a self-awareness of the reasons behind one's own actions. To me, this is both a skill to be developed and a process that we never complete fully. Stephen also talked about the importance of contemplative practice, which, as I mentioned, is a major theme of the Garrison Institute, as well as the importance of combining contemplation with action, which he recently wrote a blog entry on that I'll post in the show notes along with his academic articles that we discuss. I will say that during our interview, Stephen really seemed to embody the principles of contemplation that we were discussing, and I found myself almost being soothed by my discussion with him as we went along. So I really enjoyed speaking with Stephen, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. So, Stephen, I should say, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for spending your time with me today. I'm looking forward to chatting with you about your career and your current work.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So, Stephen, I want to start with, and this is no surprise, I was just mentioning this, the origin story question that I start every interview of the podcast now with. When you look back on your career, how do you make sense of it? What are some key moments, experiences, decisions that you made or have that kind of lead you to where you are?
That's such a good question. For me, a common thread in the journey of my meandery trajectory to this part of my career is that it's about relationships and about the role that I can play in helping build relationships between people and between people and the rest of the living planet. So there was one moment that was a sort of defining critical juncture in my career path. And this was early on in college. I was studying astronomy and physics, and I had just returned from a trip home to Baltimore, where I'm from. And at the time I was doing a National Science Foundation summer research fellowship in astrophysics. And so I was sitting there in an observatory looking at a computer screen that was full of galaxies, a bunch of blips, hundreds of blips on the screen, and each blip being a galaxy composed of hundreds of millions of stars. And there was a moment where I realized that I was staring out into the deep universe, looking at ancient light. But right here, right now, around me on this planet, there were so many social, ecological issues that that I could instead flip the observational lens 180 degrees to study what's happening here and to apply myself to helping address some of these issues. So that was just one of those stark moments sitting in that observatory that summer, 20 some years ago, where I decided to shift from studying physics and astronomy to studying and acting within social ecological systems. And one other key piece I'll share really briefly is that from there, I moved into education and I went to graduate school after college. I took a little bit of a break to work doing things that I did growing up, taking care of trees in Baltimore, and then moved out to California and taught math at City College of San Francisco and did some other jobs. But I really felt like education was a key vehicle for social change. And so I thought that better understanding how people learned and how people acquired new insights and how people came to mutual understanding was like a way that I could have agency in helping create the conditions for addressing the social ecological issues around me. And then after going deep into education, you know, in a naive sort of way, it came to the realization that education, while really critical, is just not sufficient. It's not about people not knowing what to do to govern the commons or to manage the impacts of our operations on Earth. It's not that we don't know the ways to tread more lightly. It's about what we do and other motivating forces that influence how we behave and how we act and how we are in relation with Earth.
I can't resist asking an immediate follow-up question to what you just said, because I've heard this a fair amount from a type of person who initially starts studying ecology and says, okay, well, I'm tired of developing more and more precise measurements of what's going wrong. I want to think about human behavior and how it can be changed to impact what's going wrong. And a question I've asked myself as a social scientist is, how much can the same logic that you just described also apply to social science? And I don't say this dismissively, as if I think that we're all done with social science, but I wonder how much more knowledge of human behavior do we need versus how much action do we need? Like, where is the real bottleneck? Because I think it's tempting as a social scientist to say, well, we need to continue to develop more and more precise understandings of human behavior. But I feel like we understand a fair amount of human behavior fairly well, at least at the level of granularity that we would need to kind of ideally nudge folks in one direction or another. Do you have a take on this?
Yeah, I agree. And that is why I moved towards doing work in what some people call boundary spanning, because it's really about, for me, we know X, Y, and Z, but so what? What does it mean? And how can we use that understanding to be better? There's a famous quote from Maya Angelou, right? Like, now that I know better, I can do better. And that's sort of this, that's like a very accurate way to describe boundary spanning. I think a lot of, I just read an interesting quote from a famous ecologist who said essentially that, you know, I've been writing the obituary for planet Earth for decades. And so I'm interested in moving from like diagnosing all of these issues to treating them and to addressing them. You know, inspiring action with the research, doing decision-relevant science. And in social science, I suppose it wouldn't quite be the same, but I think there is, you know, something I have heard from a lot of folks is that, you know, lamenting that we know these things and yet people aren't acting differently, or decisions aren't being changed, or policy isn't incorporating or you know, being based on the evidence from science and research. And it can be a real challenge. And I think a reason why we need to also focus really deliberately on connecting what we know from science with what we do in policy.
Let's actually dive right into your work on boundary spanning. Could you share with me what the kind of theoretical and practical significance of this type of actor is? Like, why is this type of actor important and in what context?
Yeah, I love this stuff. It's so fascinating to me. And people have been doing work on the science policy interface for decades. This goes way back. You know, Carol Weiss, for example, in I think the 70s, and others even before then, who are really interested in questions about how is science used and useful? How are different types of evidence used in decision-making, in policy settings? And we can think about how evidence can be used strategically, right, to achieve a kind of predetermined outcome or goal. We can think about how evidence can be used conceptually to change people's minds and to shape the language and the public debate about issues, the dialogue. And we can think about evidence being used kind of instrumentally to make a specific decision in like a cost-benefit analysis type of way, right? To make an either-or decision or decide which way to go. And a whole bunch of other types of use. And I'm just fascinated that a lot of these studies have found that the most common type of use of evidence is conceptual. It's about changing people's minds. It's about how people change their own minds based on new information and new insight. So theoretically, there's been quite a bit of work on the science-policy interface. And even more recently, thing like what Esther Turnhout calls the governance knowledge systems interface. So it's a lot more complex and nuanced and kind of interconnected than just science policy. It's about the networks of relationships and the ways in which knowledge systems are kind of governed and the ways in which they emerge and the ways in which governance, you know, in the same is managed and emerges. Practically, it looks like on the ground work to build relationships, to communicate information in different directions between communities that may not be already communicating with each other, to provide some knowledge exchange infrastructure to facilitate knowledge exchange, to make it easier for people who are in policy jobs to talk with people who are in academic research jobs. Because these are different communities, and so they have different kinds of customs. If you think about the language that that people will use at an academic conference versus around the table in a policy meeting, it's very different language. If you think about the clothes that they're wearing, you know, I could get away with jean shorts and chacos at an ecology conference that happens every year, but if I wore that in DC at a White House roundtable, I'd be laughed out of the room. So like the very nature of how these communities operate, it can be like in very different worlds. And so practically, I think there needs to be a lot of attention just given to the connective tissue between these communities so that what we know can be translated into what we do.
So Stephen, one of the things I want to unpack here is how diverse this type of actor can be. I think when I hear the concept of a boundary spanner, and particularly when you start talking about the science policy interface, there's this concept that I've been using more in my teaching, and it's a really awkwardly named concept called the representativeness heuristic, which is when you hear about a concept, your brain immediately comes up with a kind of archetypal image, and that image kind of fills what you imagine that concept to be, which is in some ways unavoidable, but also kind of artificially constricts this diversity of what the reality actually is like. So how that worked for me when you said science policy interface is, okay, is there a scientist who's marching down to DC and trying to get some policymakers to actually listen to the latest ecological disaster story, the ozone hole, whatever it is? I feel like that's a very common narrative that we use to fill this space. I suppose you could also think about, say, a journalist going to an academic conference and trying to help scientists communicate their knowledge better. That's also a kind of a pretty common role that definitely does exist. In either case, you kind of have one common thread there. It seems to be that you have someone who's initially from one of the communities reaching out to a different community to kind of bridge the gap. How much do these images characterize your thinking, and in what ways are they insufficient for describing the kind of diversity of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, you very neatly described a figure in a paper that attempts to visually diagram how it can happen, right? So I think it is accurate, and there are some other arrangements of the people involved in this work that have been kind of documented and studied. So in one case, you know, and if we just think of a very simple model, right? Scientists and policymakers and then boundary spanners. Just to be very simplistic in describing these things and how they act and how they're related, we could have a scientist who is accountable to the science community in their work and in their career, and they will go into policy settings and they will communicate the science. And we see this all the time: congressional testimony, people who are willing to engage with decision makers and help them understand what they're finding in their research. On the other hand, we can have policymakers who are willing to step out of that professional culture they spend most of their time in, the policy setting that they're accountable to, and they can join scientists and share about, you know, what they're grappling with, what are the decisions that they're facing, and what kind of research would be really useful to know about. Again, accountability being towed just mostly to the policy setting. When there are what I call like boundary spanners involved, typically the lines of accountability are balanced to both the scientists and to the policymakers. And that's really important because boundary spanning is about not determining the outcomes of decision-making, but helping to inform it and helping to helping to base decision-making on the most recent evidence that we have from the research world and from science. So those lines of accountability, I think, are important, and boundary spanners can kind of exist in an independent nonprofit organization. They can exist, for example, Federation of American Scientists or Global Council on Science and Environment, AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and they have a whole science and technology policy fellowship program to make it easier for scientists to play this kind of role. And so they're, you know, boundary spanners can be embedded within kind of third party organizations or within science groups or within policy groups, as long as those lines of accountability are pretty strong to the interaction and the relationship among the communities. I think that that's just an important component of what I'm picturing in my mind.
Stephen, I'm picking up a lot on this idea of, I want to kind of think of an adjective here, but symmetric, it's not quite the right word, but this idea of accountability is not something I had thought a lot about before in relation to this idea of a boundary spanner. Could you say a bit more about why it's important for a boundary spanner to be accountable to multiple communities? It sounds like could be because it helps them be a faithful representative of those communities. Is that close to the logic?
Exactly. It's such an important ingredient to make the wonderful recipe of trust. It's so important for trust, right? A boundary spanner, in the ideal sense, is trusted by the scientists to do right by the research and represent it in a credible way and kind of line up the opportunities for the scientists to represent it themselves and then get out of the way. A boundary spanner is also very trusted by policymakers to have those deeper conversations about inside baseball, like what's happening and what are the dynamics, who are the players and the rules of the situation and where is the power, right? And like what's at stake. And then to be able to communicate that in an intelligible way to the scientists, and not trying really to influence one or the other than getting people in the room together so that they can communicate and exchange knowledge in ways that make sense to each other. And so, yeah, that trust is a really key aspect.
So before I move on to the next question, I'm also picking up on, you've said this a couple of times now, Stephen, this idea of not being what you could pejoratively say is being overbearing, not trying to exert undue influence And when I hear that, my initial response is to think, well, that sounds really good. Of course, we don't want that. But you could imagine someone responding by saying, well, why wouldn't that be a part of the package here? Why wouldn't a part of the value of a boundary spanner be, you know, again, evoking this archetypal scientist who, you know, flies into DC? Why wouldn't you want that person to have a strong advocacy role? Or is that too simplistic? Can someone be an advocate and still behave the way that you're describing?
And it's such a good question. And it's so core to the work of boundary spanners. I would always view it as sort of like a spectrum, and people can show up as really strident advocates for a particular policy solution, or they can show up claiming a little more objectivity and like, here are the facts, here's what we've uncovered. You can do what you will with them, but I'm not going to tell you how to use them to make your decision. I'm going to let the decision maker make the decision. And then everywhere in between those extremes, right? And so I would always view my role when I was doing boundary spanning work really as an opportunity to help people consciously make that decision, to know what the risks and the opportunities are of coming out as a strident advocate, and know what the risks and opportunities are of claiming objectivity in a scientific sense. And I think that people need to decide for themselves how they want to show up, and the more they can do that in a careful way, I think the more effective they can be in playing the kind of role they would like to play in the science policy interface or the governance knowledge systems interface. I think there is a lot of stealth advocacy that happens, right? It's a term that's been used by people to describe the person who's really advocating for a particular outcome, but not saying it openly, maybe. That happens all the time. And many policymakers are pretty savvy and they can detect that quickly. It's easy for them to see that. And it's, you know, this brings up the role of values and sort of like an ethical dimension to this work that I think is really important. And would probably need another podcast to go into depth on, but just to say that I think there is a certain responsibility that's involved in this line of work, in this sort of career. And I don't take that lightly, and I don't mean to kick the can or punt on that one, but I think it is a conversation that's worth having at some point.
Okay. And so building more on this idea, Stephen, that there's characteristics that you want in a boundary spanner, say this kind of mutual accountability. I know that you've thought about and written about what are some important strategies for boundary spanners to use, and what are some important characteristics for boundary spanners to have, which seems like a very natural question to ask, right? If we like boundary spanners, and I think there's a lot of, there's an intuitive reason to want to understand the need for boundary spanners, right? The world is very groupish. You need people to span different groups just in general in order to promote collaboration across groups, whatever the groups might be, in lots of situations. We see that kind of dilemma, I think, frankly, almost everywhere we might really care to look. So that importance does beg the question, how do you make a good boundary spanner? And so half of that is, you know, what are the actual tools? What are the behavioral tricks of the trade? And also, and this is something that to me is a little bit more challenging, maybe, what type of person makes a good boundary spanner? And some of that might have to do with identity as well and might be context specific. And so one thing I wonder there is how much of this can be taught versus how much of this has to do with, it does seem to me that there are some harder to train qualities in someone that can help them gain trust among different groups. So I'm wondering on your thoughts on that whole package of how do we find and promote good boundary spanners?
Yeah, I don't know if anybody is born as a really good boundary spanner, but I imagine there are, you know, some innate tendencies or traits that people have that make them really effective at it. And I've both studied this sort of question and worked on the ground, like in the field, doing the connecting work, and a lot at the same time, really. Like during my PhD work, I was working the whole time through it for those 3 years, doing this sort of work. So I very much was like actively engaged. And what we learned from studying it, you know, we were commissioned by National Academies of Sciences to study boundary spanning and intermediaries and brokers, knowledge brokers across the environment, the health and the education sectors, and look for patterns. And the language is different. Some groups call it brokers, some call it intermediaries, some call it boundary spanners. So we identified some differences in how people talked about and conceived of these roles, and some patterns and similarities. And we looked at the research and the review papers that were done about this. So we reviewed 180 or so. Some of the things that boundary spanners do, which are really important, I think, to think about this as a verb, not necessarily a noun. Like, what is boundary spanning work? Well, it's a lot about facilitating relationships. That's how it's described in conceptual and review papers. And that's how it's done in practice. It's facilitating relationships. It's like creating connections and acting as like a mycelial network to facilitate the flow of information and resources through networks. Another thing that is also really common is boundary spanning involves disseminating evidence. It's about communication. And so that's one of the traits that is really important. People who are clear and careful communicators and that are using words intentionally to convey meaning in ways that are understandable by others who might be from a totally different background. What's interesting about communication is that often in graduate school as scientists, we're trained to communicate in the exact opposite way that works really well when communicating with policymakers or journalists or laypeople or anybody who's not also a scientist, right? You think about the entire like history of research that's happened, doing that literature review, thinking about all of the other greats who have come first and done research that you're building on, and then the methods, right, and the statistical test we used, and what was the p-value of that test, and why do we pick that test in particular? And then eventually at the bottom right corner of that science poster would be like the main point. And when communicating in policy settings, you want to actually go right to that main point as quickly as possible. Sometimes you might only have like 15 or 20 seconds to get to the point of like, why are we having this conversation and why does it matter for the policy issue that you're addressing? So communication is really key. Good communicators, people who are willing to learn and practice, because it takes a lot of practice to communicate in ways that resonate with different audiences and community members. Lastly, I'll just add that, you know, finding alignment is another thing that is like an important function of boundary spanners. And the people who are good at doing this are really like, really kind of like open to engaging in social change processes. They're willing to not necessarily like know the outcome when they get started, but be willing to like stick with it and navigate social networks and interactions with individuals and groups, and then look for alignment, like find alignment or create alignment. Sometimes it can be sort of that there is alignment and it's just hidden and we don't know it until we uncover it through dialogue. But finding that alignment is a really key thing, because those are, I love it. I love it when there's sort of like that moment of people seeing each other on the same level and kind of realizing what each other is talking about. And then realizing like, oh, well, that means that we can do this and it would likely have that outcome according to the research. And I've seen that moment happen, and it's really kind of rewarding and a fun thing.
Steven, I really like your points about meaning. It's something I think a lot about, that It sounds kind of trivial, right? Like, well, communicate with meaning, but it's I feel like it's one of the main things we try to teach students, right? Is how do you actually communicate meaningfully? How do you make the words on the page do work for you as opposed to you kind of putting them down there kind of without enough deliberation about the purpose that they're serving? I also like the idea of practice. You know, I think that often it sounds, again, to me, it's one of these things that sounds trivial. Well, like, of course, I've known that practice is important since my parents told me I need to sit back down at the piano bench, right? But it's funny. It's these things that we know are important in a part of our brain, but then we just don't do, right? I think about this a lot in the context of like public speaking or giving a lecture, et cetera. We know these things matter and then we simply don't do them, but we don't generally practice this. But you'd never like go and play a basketball game without practicing. And if you did, you shouldn't judge yourself negatively for having a bad game. You didn't practice it. And yet people will go give a talk without practicing it and then feel bad. And it's like, well, yeah, if you should feel bad, it's because you didn't practice, not because you didn't do well. And I feel like there's some overlap between that context and what you're talking about is engaging with people. And we kind of all assume that like, oh, the words will just come the way I want them to because I speak English if I'm speaking with other English speakers, right? And of course I'll be able to do it fine. But of course you won't do it as well as you'd want to if you haven't actually practiced it. The final question I'd like to ask you, Stephen, about this idea of boundary spanning before moving on to your current position at the Garris Institute and thinking about your career again is boundary spanning kind of a panacea? Is it always a good thing? When you mention the word intermediary, in my field, the most common context in which we talk about intermediaries are market intermediaries, right? So someone who buys fish or charcoal from a natural resource user. And there's a common criticism, or at least a common concern expressed about this type of actor, that they can exert in the worst case, kind of predatory influence over natural resource users and economically pinch them to get to garner more economic benefit for themselves. So is this role of a boundary spanner, is that scenario kind of too far afield? Am I kind of comparing apples and oranges? And or is there a potential problematic nature that someone who mediates relationships between different groups can also play that's not necessarily good for both groups or even either one of them?
Yeah, absolutely. I can think of a bunch of cases where an intermediary like increased transaction costs and just made it take longer or be more cumbersome or more expensive or whatever in different ways. And lots of cases where someone who's claiming neutrality or claiming accountability to all the parties isn't really doing a good job mediating because they have an outcome in mind that they would like to steer towards. And so they're influencing things more in like a lobbying kind of way. So it definitely happens. It's sort of the dark side of boundary spanning work that some folks have written a bit about. That as a boundary spanner, my own values and ideas about what should take place would influence the way in which I do the work. And I think anybody in like conflict resolution or negotiation or mediation or even like therapy for that matter, has to do a little bit of kind of like self-attention work to note when one's own ideas and values are influencing things in a way that isn't really helpful, or that is maybe not the role that one is hoping to play or intending to play. But I would say that the translation of science to policy and the translation of what policymakers are doing to scientists doesn't often happen on its own accord. Without deliberate attention to this role, without people doing this work, I think sometimes what we're learning in science, we can talk about it and it's just like talking right past people in policy and vice versa. And science is like untethered from being relevant to decisions that are happening today, right? We're doing science that is like really interesting, but maybe not helping address the issues that are happening today right now. And there's a role for basic research for sure. I think it's really important that we support and continue to do basic research that isn't obvious in how it's going to be applied one day. But the nature of the contemporary global challenges we're facing is such that we got to do some more decision relevant stuff. Like, we've got to think about how the research will be used to effect positive change in the world. Otherwise, we're going to be continuing to just pour energy into systems that are not compatible with things like planetary health. And I think boundary spanning can help link up what we know with what we do in ways that generate more planetary health.
I'd like to finish up by returning to our discussion of your career. So you earned a PhD from the University of Vermont, and after that, you were the Director of Policy and Partnerships at the Gund Institute for Environment at the University of Vermont. And most recently, you've become the Director of Pathways to Planetary Health at the Garrison Institute. I'd like to primarily focus on your time at the Garrison Institute, although if you want to chat a little bit about your previous experience positions, we can. Can you talk to me about your path to the Garrison Institute and give a little bit of background about the organization and what your role in it now is?
Yeah, and in there, I also worked at an organization called Compass, which is based in DC and also on the West Coast, and is a real boundary spanning organization in many ways. So I've been living in Vermont for about 20 years, but worked with them based out of the DC office doing federal science policy connecting work for a good 5 years there. Right now, you know, I'm with this organization called Garrison Institute, and I've been here about a year, a little bit less. This is one of these, I'll call it an innovative organization, because it's really about applied contemplative practice and contemplative wisdom. We take what we know from science with what we learn from contemplative practice, and then we bring that to bear on contemporary issues. In my case, social ecological issues, planetary health issues. So I'm focused on how we can integrate scientific inquiry with other kinds of ancient wisdom practices, or with other types of evidence for how we understand the world, to then improve the health of all life on Earth. So I think many of us feel the imbalance in the way things have been. We have many systems in the planet right now that are not really compatible with health on a planetary sense, or even on a human in a human way. But many of our reactions to realizing this can become in themselves like very unhealthy, right? The anxiety and the grief and the rest of the emotional kind of reactions to confronting climate change and the disruptions that it's causing. These reactions and mindsets can themselves become part of the crisis. So contemplative practice is one way to address these sorts of things that are happening inside of people at the same time as we're coming up with solutions for the systems that are in place. I'll add that we focus on contemplative practice across all traditions. So we'll, you know, next week we have a Christian mystic who's leading an incredible retreat at the Garrison Institute. This week, we'll be sitting down with indigenous elders who bring their own spiritual traditions to bear on things like planetary health and change in society. And the week before might be somebody from a completely different tradition. And so we aren't wedded to any one particular path, but we find that there is opportunity to bring science and contemplative practices together across all traditions to find new insights and to inspire engaged action in creating change.
So, Stephen, I'm going to break a cardinal rule that I might have broken already a few times during this interview and ask you two questions at once, just partly because I don't want to forget them. One is, what do you say to someone who sounds dismissive of the importance of this idea of contemplative practice, right? There's some pejorative keywords that one might summon if it feels kind of wishy-washy, touchy-feely, right? Those are kind of dismissive ways of characterizing something that's clearly very important here. But what is the mechanism there? How is that better than kind of the default way in which we might go about something? And I guess building on that actually is doing that sounds like we're doing some boundary spanning, right? I mean, the way you're describing it sounds like we're still actually very much talking about boundary spanning. And I'd love for you to reflect on that as well and your continued role individually and organizationally as a boundary spanner. Does that label make sense to what we're talking about still now? So those are the two questions.
I would say that there is a mountain, a growing mountain of evidence that mindfulness practice, for example, has clear, tangible benefits for people who are scientists, people who are professional athletes, people who are in policy. It's been used in UK Parliament. It's been used with peak performing athletes, and it's been used with scientists who are grappling with the findings of their research and the implications and what their findings mean for the world. So I think it's clear, and it's medical evidence. There are data, there are randomized control trials, there are people going into MRIs while meditating or while engaging in contemplative practice and in different ways, and just mountains of evidence. So the data, I think, are pretty clear that it can be helpful in schools and just across settings. It can help imbue people with more compassion, more awareness of interconnectedness, more camaraderie and just better cooperation when tackling some of the challenges that we're facing and these kinds of things. Importantly, it needs to be linked with action because I think some of the criticisms of contemplative practice are really fair if we're just kind of sitting on a cushion and then not doing anything with that. And the lack of access that some people have, I think, to a 5-day retreat. It's not easy for most people to just take that time away and do that kind of thing. So I think the contemplative practice really needs to inspire action, and it needs to be linked with engagement in the world, brought off of the cushion, so to speak. And it is really similar to boundary spanning in a lot of ways. I mean, the work I'm doing now is a lot of fun in that way because, I'm helping facilitate exchange among people who are scientists and people who are spiritual leaders and people who are policymakers still. I'm very engaged in things around biodiversity stewardship in the US, federal policy-wise, and also internationally. Conversations and projects that lead to action on things like regenerative economies, work on reimagining the commons and how can we rediscover ethical frameworks in the way we do our economic activities and kind of the architecture of the macro economy. I think it's like really important work, and it is made stronger by the integration of contemplative practice. I would say it is very similar to boundary spanning in a lot of ways.
So Stephen, could you talk to me about what your goals are for your position moving forward? Kind of what are you hoping to personally and collectively get out of this? And how does it relate to how you make sense of your future career arc? So kind of returning to the origin story question, but kind of pointing the arrow forward now. How do you think about that?
I mean, for me, it is about it's about developing relationships among people and between people and the rest of the living planet. And it's about balance. It's about, regaining balance when things are tipped out of alignment in the Earth systems that we're all a part of. So that's sort of the larger arc. That's sort of the goal of the work. That's where I see things headed. I think a lot about the events that we can do at the Garrison Institute and with the Pathways to Planetary Health Initiative. We have this beautiful retreat sanctuary space. It's in the Hudson Valley. It's just an hour north of New York City. And we have the opportunity to invite people together for roundtables and workshops and and symposiums that we do around planetary health every year to larger gatherings. And we have a large gathering, you know, 300 or 400 people coming together in New York City later this week. I'll be heading down to the Hudson Valley shortly to engage with our 20th anniversary forum called Metamorphosis. But it's a lot more than just the events. The planetary health work is, while the events are really important, it's a lot about engaging in projects that help people remember the interconnectedness of things as we're doing our work, that help reveal new generative social fields as they're emerging, and that help help build partnerships, because it really is about being in concert with others, I think, doing work towards planetary health right now in a way that helps bring it about and helps it emerge in the future.
Well, this has been great, Stephen. And thank you for that last response. We haven't gotten to everything I know in the interview notes that I prepared before, but are there any topics that you'd like to make sure we touch on before we wrap up? Or are there topics that you want to return to tie more of a bow on before we wrap up?
I guess one last thought is just something I've been considering lately is something I shared with you the other day, Michael, just the idea that a lot of work in relation to the commons can be about how do we take care of the commons? How do we steward it? How do we better govern the commons? How do we create rules or design principles to interact with each other and with resources and with the social norms that are all kind of part of the commons? And I've been thinking about the opposite of that question and how the commons impacts us and how the experience of the commons affects our worldviews and the ways we see ourselves as agents of change within the world, and our own sorts of our own like sense of identity, and what that means, how that can affect planetary health going forward.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can find more episodes as well as entries in our blog on our website, incommonpodcast.org. The Incommon Podcast is the official podcast of the International Association for the Study of the Commons, or IASC.